We know that no one can succeed alone. Since the Second World War, more than 120,000 Norwegian women and men have served shoulder to shoulder with friends and allied forces. They have participated in almost 100 missions, fighting for values on which we build our societies. A bridge of trust has been built between our brothers in arms and our allied countries. Some soldiers did not make it home, and many suffered injuries. A few have been honored as war heroes. None should be forgotten.
Welcome to another episode in Friends and Allies, story brought to you by Et Øyeblikk en Evighet. With me today, I am very proud to announce that we have General Sir Michael Rose. Welcome to you, sir.
Thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Some of you will remember him from incidents like the terrorist attack on the Iranian embassy in London, maybe some trips to the Falkland Wars, but also as a commanding officer of the UNPROFOR in the Balkan Wars. And we're coming back to that. But sir, you're actually born in India.
I was actually born in India. I come from a long line of Indian colonists, as the people would like to call them today. My father, grandfather and great-grandfather have served in India for three or four generations and first of all started with the East India Company when India was run by a commercial organization, not by the government of India.
So you come from a long line of, servicemen or people from the army, but the army in India.
That's exactly correct. And of course, when the Indian Army came to an end in 1947, when the Indian gained independence, I was then obliged to look for an English regiment to join and join the Coldstream Guards.
But you didn't end up in the Coldstream Guards because your military career was quite colourful, actually. You jumped around a bit.
Well, the Coldstream Guards were a wonderful base for all military careers, in my view. It was a founder member of the new modern British Army, founded in 1960s by General Monk. And, of course, the traditions and the standards and the values that go back as long as 350 years are a wonderful way to start your army career. But after three or four years, the Special Air Service Regiment based in Hereford were looking to start a guard squadron. And, of course, being in the Coldstream Guards, I was attracted by that and went off and did many tours with the SAS and rather left the Coldstream Guards behind until later on when I became the colonel of the regiment.
You went to the Troubles to Northern Ireland?
Yeah, in everyone so did many, many tours in Northern Ireland. I never call them the Troubles. That, in my view, is an IRA terrorist propaganda word. I call them the IRA terrorist campaign that fought in Northern Ireland by the IRA terrorists for nearly 30 years. And, of course, in that time killed over 3,000 people, many of whom were Catholics and nationalists on whom side the IRA terrorists claimed they were fighting for.
Would you consider it as a sort of a victory when the whole thing stopped?
Well, of course, because the IRA terrorist campaign was based on using armed force in order to create a unified Ireland and force the people in the north to join the Southern Irish Republic. And, of course, that totally failed. It failed on a number of accounts, but most of all because of the framework operations that were carried out by the British Army over those many years were very careful in the way they approached the use of force in what was basically a peacekeeping mission. And by being able to penetrate the IRA terrorist organization and ultimately getting control of that organization, it was possible to bring that conflict to an end. But make no mistake about it, it was a very violent, very well-organized terrorist campaign. And I guess the lessons could be learned today by Israel in its handling of Hamas and Hezbollah.
Well, that's a question we will probably see in the years to come. Your highlight at the time was with another terrorist attack on the Iranian embassy here in London. And initially, as I understand it, the SIS wasn't a part of it. They didn't call you first.
Now, what happened was the SAS and the Home Office and the Foreign Office and the cabinet office had been exercising many times on counter-terrorist exercises, and there happened to be a counter-terrorist exercise beginning to start at the time that had been carefully rehearsed beforehand. And in Hereford, we were getting some of the early warnings that we were about to be deployed on a counter-terrorist exercise. And in the midst of that, I got a call saying that there was a real terrorist incident taking place in London from one of my former soldiers, who at that point was in the Metropolitan Police and was a dog handler, and it was actually at the Iranian embassy and had seen that it had been taken over by armed terrorists. So he called me in Hereford saying, I think you ought to get yourselves down here because I don't think the Metropolitan Police are going to be able to handle this issue. I rang the Ministry of Defence, who told me to stay where I was and to carry on with the exercise that we were in the midst of. And of course, I ignored that completely, jumped in a helicopter, deployed my soldiers, and arrived in London a good deal earlier than the Ministry of Defence would have otherwise allowed.
And as they say, the rest is history. But it was quite intense campaign, as it turned out. There was a lot of diplomatic things. There was many layers of solution probing and anything. But in the end, you executed. You went in there.
I think one of the keys to the whole success of that operation was, first of all, there was a very clear line of command. You had the strategic, political level run by the Cabinet Office briefing room that was originally authorised by Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister, to the Home Secretary, who was an ex-Second World War, ex-Scots Guards officer who had a military cross called Willie Whitelaw, who was the Home Secretary. And he chaired the strategic level decision-making body, which was called the COBRA in short. At the next level down, John Delle, who was the Assistant Chief Commissioner of Police in the Metropolitan Police Force, was in command of the operational level, that is, getting together the military, the civil, and all the other elements together and running the negotiating teams with the terrorists. And then at the working level, the tactical level, you then had the police cordon, the police snipers, and of course the SAS element down on the ground that was getting ready in case a military assault was actually needed. So only having three levels of command made the passage of information and intelligence up and down those levels of command extremely. We all understood each other. We all knew each other from previous exercises. So it all worked extremely well. And that, in a way, apart from the professionalism and the courage of the soldiers who actually had to do the military assault, one of the keys to the success was that extremely good, simple communication chain that ran up and down. Today, I fear there are five or six levels of command, and I don't think it would work quite as simply as it did in 1980.
Let's pray we never find out. Were you ever in doubt when you gave the order to go in?
No, there was never any doubt. I had the best trained soldiers in the world, and although we were up against a well-trained terrorist team, there was no way they were going to cope with the soldiers that they met face-to-face in that building.
And that turned out very exactly as you said. Time after, the Argentinians took hold of the Falklands Island and the Brits went down there to kick them out. Did you train for that operation? Were you even on the chart, or was it another operation that you had to sneak your way into?
Well, two things about that. One is that we had been training a lot in northern Norway, and therefore we were quite used to cold weather conditions and the sort of terrain in which we were operating in the Falkland Islands, although there was less snow than one would have had in when we were training in Norway. And secondly, the Ministry of Defence, at that time it was run by the Navy, the Falkland Islands operation, of course hadn't really included the SS in their order of battle. So I'd worked in Northern Ireland with the commander of the task of the force that was going to be deployed. And I rang him up and said, I think you're going to need the SAS because there hasn't been a single war fought since the end of the Second World War without the critical involvement of the SAS. And he was surprised that we had not been put on the order of battle for that task force sailing south. So he immediately invited me to join his headquarters, which I did. And we were able to get a squadron and then another squadron down to the south through back channels in the Ministry of Defence.
And you played a significant role.
Well, at the time, there was no knowledge of where the deployments or the capabilities or indeed the state of morale or the combat effectiveness of the Argentine forces were. It was a completely blank sheet of paper. But by being able to deploy the SS patrols into the Falkland Islands a month ahead of the main landings, we were able to produce all the necessary intelligence that was needed to plan the final battle for the Port Stanley, which of course was the vital ground in that war. Once we took Port Stanley, one had won the war. And indeed, one could go back a step and say that the mountains surrounding Port Stanley were dominated by Mount Kent. And once one had taken Mount Kent, which was in effect with the Monte Cassino on the road to Rome, then one had won the war. And it was, of course, the SS who originally took control of Mount Kent, prevented the Argentines coming up there and regaining it, which allowed the main attack to take place into Port Stanley. So when I asked the brigadier who commanded the land forces once, could the war have been won without the SS, as had been the original proposal, he said, well, possibly, but it would have taken a great deal of longer. And I think probably, since time was not on our side, it would not have been won without that critical information and intelligence being produced. And of course, we also carried out some offensive action by taking out the ground attack aircraft, the Pucara, on Pebble Island, and also destroying some of their heavy lift helicopters, which were needed to transport the Argentine forces from their centres of where they were staying in Port Stanley or in Darwin Goose Green, to try and wall us off in San Carlos Water, where the beachhead was, and their strategy was to try and create a Gallipoli situation where they dominated the high ground around the beachhead, and finally the Navy and Army would have to withdraw. And of course, that never happened.
Did you personally get learn them and experiences from both the Iranian embassy incident and also the Falkland War that you have brought with you after?
Well, many lessons one learned. The first one is keep the chain of command very simple. And we had a simple chain of command in the Iranian MCC. And my relationships with Julian Thompson were one-to-one. I was embedded in his headquarters. So everything that I did on the SS patrol did in the Falkland Islands was based on his requirement. And there was no interference from on high or from below, other than, unfortunately, the Navy decided that Darwin Goose Green was a threat to the advance on Port Stanley and decided to deploy two para to go and eliminate that garrison, when in the understanding of the of us, of the SAS, and also the Marine commanders, it was no more than a self-administering prisoner of war camp. It was actually an airfield there with a defensive battalion around it who were never going to attack the British from their rather isolated position on Darwin Goose Green. And it was a completely unnecessary operation, which wasted a lot of resources and cost a lot of unnecessary lives, including the life of my own friend, Colonel H. Jones, who commanded Two Para, in doing what was effectively a complete waste of time.
In the years to come after the Falkland operation, did you just sit home and shuffle papers, or did you stroll around?
No, after the Falkland War, I then stayed on in the armed forces and went on ultimately to become the commander of the United Nations Protection Force in Bosnia, which was my last operational job before I did leave the army.
Yeah, but you took over as force commander in 93?
No, I took over the force commander just at the start of 94. I think it was the 3rd or 4th of January 1994, when the war was still three-sided. And obviously the my predecessor had left prematurely, because as he put it, he could no longer withstand the psychological pressures of trying to do a job with inadequate resources and lack of political support. And if you remember at the time, beginning of 1994, Boutros Ghali, the Secretary General, and indeed the 16 different troop contributing nations had stated that they were going to withdraw that mission at the beginning in the spring of 1994. At the beginning of April. But in fact, that mission was needed to continue to deliver humanitarian aid, of whom to 2.7 million people who were daily dependent on that aid. And without that aid, they would have died or suffered greatly. So it was very important to keep that mission going. So my first job on arrival was to reinvigorate that mission and to persuade the politicians, international politicians, to keep their support for that mission.
At the time, did you feel that you were more a diplomat than a general?
No, never that. It was always it was always going to be a military support to what was a humanitarian. I mean, the first thing I did was to go to New York And the head of the peacekeeping department was Kofi Annan at the time. And we had a meeting of the ambassadors from the 16 troop contributing nations, plus Lavrov, who was he's still around in the Russian Foreign Service. He's now their foreign minister. He was a young man at the time. He attended the meeting. And Madeleine Albright, who was the Secretary of State. And we decided to redefine what the United Nations was. It had become rather confused with a number of successive United Nations Security Council resolutions being passed in response to individual incidents happening. But it had lost its shape. And so we redefined the mission as priority one, deliver humanitarian aid. Priority two, try and create an environment in which there could be a political resolution of the conflict. And number three was to stop the war from spreading. And if you analyze the performance of the United Nations during that time, by the end of 1994, it had achieved all those aims. The people were no longer dependent on humanitarian aid because of the peace had largely returned to that country, war-torn country. There'd been the Washington Accords, which halted the fighting between the Muslims and the Croats. And so now it was a two-sided war, with the Serbs very much wanting to stop the war themselves. And it was only, as I said earlier on, the insistence of the Americans that the Muslims, Bosnian Muslims, continued with that war that collapsed the mission at the end of the day in 1995 and ended up with NATO bombing and the Dayton Peace Accord, which of course included the dreadful massacre in Srebrenica. And that happened because the NATO had discredited the UN mission on the ground and they were unable to control events themselves from the air.
As a force commander in Bosnia, you also had Norwegian troops under your command. Can you recall it? What did you use them for?
Well, I was very lucky to have the Norwegian because they produced a helicopter wing and they were extremely capable pilots. They were used to flying in bad weather. They were used to flying in snow, blizzards. And we were whenever we needed something done through helicopter flights, they were always the people we could call on. They were extremely robust organization, a part of the peacekeeping.
And one particular place and an incident was with Majak city, who was besieged.
Well, there was a pair. There was up in the northwest area of Bosnia. There was an area called Maglaj. There was an enclave. There were six enclaves there at the time. That was one of them that was being suffered greatly from the Serbs besieging them and shelling them. And they hadn't had any humanitarian aid delivered there for, I think, 2 or 3 months. And the result was that they were starving. And of course, the temperatures, that dropped to minus 20 degrees. I know in Norwegian, that would seem like getting out of the airplane in Bahrain. But actually, to the people of Maglaj, it was kind of critical. They needed fuel, they needed supplies. And I heard that from the UN representative there called Larry Hollingsworth. So we decided to put some special forces called the Joint Commission Officers into there. And the only way we could really get them in was by helicopter, covert helicopter flights in the middle of the night. But of course, her Serbs were quite well equipped with radars and they saw them coming and they fired, I think, seven SAM 7s at the helicopters, who took very good evasive action and were able to deliver the special forces on the ground, who then subsequently were able to bring in the land forces. But it was extremely courageous of the Norwegian helicopter pilots to, having had one missile fire, them to keep continuing to go on complete the mission, which was actually critical for the point of view of the people of Maglaj. And they, today, if you went to Maglaj, they would be very praiseworthy of the Norwegian air, who delivered the original first elements of their survival.
A UN operation is, of course, a joint venture from a lot of nations, as you mentioned earlier. How do you cope with so many different nations and doctrines and way of seeing things and education and everything? How can you make a doable force out of something like that?
Well, of course, it appears from the outside to be quite complex because you've got all the troop contributing nations who have their own national agendas, who have been their troops deployed on the ground as peacekeepers have their own restrictions and limitations placed on them as to what they can and can't do. Because after all, they've gone there to help deliver humanitarian aid, not fight a war against the Serbs or the Croats or the Muslims. And therefore, it's terribly important that you recognize that those people are volunteers and have their own legal and their own political limitations placed upon them. Equally, on the other side, they all want to make sure that the job is done correctly, because it's critically important for the people of Bosnia, whether they be Serb, Croatian or Muslim, to have that aid delivered to them and try to return that country back to peace. And that, in a way, that mission statement is sufficient to override all those different national agendas. And if there is a problem with a national agenda, for example, Kofi Annan told me that we would never be able to move the headquarters from Kisiljak, which was an old Olympic village, 40 miles from Sarajevo, which is where the center of gravity and where the real action was taking place. We'd never be able to move them because each nation had their own national red card. And if we tried to move them, they'd wave the red card and stop that happening. Well, of course, I took the simple decision of turning the electricity and the water off. And the end of that was they all had to move to Sarajevo or leave the country. And some did one and some did the other. And that put it into a much more effective response to what was needed on the ground. The other thing we did was to co-locate the UN High Commissioner office with the military office. So if ever there was a problem on the aid side, they could open a hatch in the door and say, look, we've got a problem. But equally, if there was a problem with the military side, and they could open the door and the military had identified an area of need, they could open the same hatch and say, we need aid in some such a place which maybe the UNHCR hadn't been approved. So it started to become a very worked out, simple solutions on the ground, although it may seem very complicated from on high.
Would you say that of all the incidents that happened in 1994, it's some years ago, all the incidents happened, which was the most grave? Because the Norwegian will say, well, it's of course the Norair helicopter thing, it's the Gorazde incident with similar to other massacre to be.
Srebrenica or whatever. Yeah.
Did you have any moments that you were thinking, oh shit, this is going to, you know, here's something's going to hit the fan?
Well, if you take Gorazde, it's quite simple. And I discussed this incidentally with General Mladic at the Hague War Crimes Tribunal. And he said to me, well, of course, we shot down a Royal Naval Sea Harrier that was bombing us, and I had absolutely right so to do, because, of course, everyone has the right of self-defense in war. And he gave me a rather an aggressive look across the courtroom. And I said to him, General Mladic, you were in contravention of United Nations Security Council 846-738-967. I made him up as I went along. And I said, what's more? I said, we warned you three times before we called in airstrikes to pull back from shelling. And of course, when we did hit you, we didn't go for the guns or the tanks that were shelling. We went for your headquarters. And that backed them off, and as a result, Gorazde was never overrun by the Serbs. And had that happened, then we'd have ended up with what happened later at Srebrenica. And of course, and I've never really asked a question, because, you know, once you're gone, and you can't make judgments. I've never understood why they didn't use NATO airstrikes against the Serbs when they were attacked the enclave of Srebrenica.
After your Bosnia Commission, that was the end of your careers, so to speak. You didn't do any more.
I did one more job in the British Army. I was on the Army board looking after what you might call human resources. So I was responsible for, you know, recruiting, training, all the human aspects and had a wonderful 2 years doing that before I finally retired.
How do you see the future? Because sometimes we discuss it here in Friends and Allies that the coming generations need to know these stories from back in the days to understand the base that they are building on. How do you find that happening here in the UK?
Well, as you know, there's been a great reconstruction of history, and people are being persuaded that their own history is something they should be ashamed of, etc., etc. I said, but in fact, if you don't understand the reality of history and what your nation stands for, then you'll never know how to develop the future. And it's terribly important that the accuracy of your planning today and your own ethical standards and values aren't based on propaganda, which is trying to make you feel ashamed of where you are and what you're trying to do in the future, and knocks it off direction. And my own view is that if you take Bosnia, the people think that the United Nations was a weak, broken-backed organization, morally corrupt, that was unable to deliver what it was needed to do in Bosnia. And it was the NATO and the use of force that achieved peace there. That is 100% wrong and is a bit of propaganda that has been produced by NATO and by the Americans, who wish to justify their action in using force, which actually achieved nothing in September 1995 when they bombed the Serbs into what they call signing up to the Dayton Peace Accord. Again, what you see in the Balkans is not what you get. That again is propaganda. What actually happened is that Milosevic and Tudjman, who were enemies, had decided between them that the resurgent Bosnian Muslim government was going to become a greater threat to each of them than they were to each other. And they had made an agreement in 1994, which was effectively the Dayton Peace Accord. In August 1994, I was handed a map by Karadzic, which is the Dayton map. And it took a whole cycle of suffering by the Bosnian people for that to actually happen. It need never have happened if America and Britain and the other so-called contact group had agreed that that map is what was going to be ultimately going to happen. Part of that was that Milosevic could not be seen to hand over the Krajinas, where 200,000, 300,000 Serbs had lived historically in Croatia. Tudjman's price was that they should be that Croatia should now occupy those Krajinas. And Tudjman and Milosevic said, I can't be seen to leave voluntarily. You'll have to be some sort of theater. We have to show us to be. Milosevic withdrew his regular army from the Krajinas to the Dayton line before Operation Storm, when the Croatians, trained by the Americans, attacked into the Krajinas, ethnically cleansed all the Serbs out, and it was just a terrible, horrible act of theater that had been agreed between Tudjman and Milosevic beforehand. And Galbraith, who was the US ambassador in Zagreb, has written a book saying how ghastly that thing was and how he realized he'd been taken for a ride by Tudjman and Milosevic. And of course, the suffering that was created by the loss of the Krajinas to the Serbs, who then had to migrate and go live in Serbia or in Bosnia, is part of the problem that we're facing today in the Balkans. And so if you use propaganda and force to, and of course, the other thing that happened is that Bush and Blair decided that that the use of force in Bosnia had created peace. They then took that formula to Kosovo, which was an illegal war, which failed. And they then took that logic and formula to Iraq. And if you're looking at what's happening in the Middle East today, the order to trail starts off in Bosnia. Force can solve complex human, economic, political problems on the ground. And of course, it cannot. And by using the propaganda, the logic of that use of force, we've ended up with the catastrophes that we see today in the Middle East.
So you have some intimate knowledge about Norway, and you have been training there, as you mentioned earlier. What is your relationship with the Norwegian forces and Norway in particular?
I was very fortunate in the mid-70s. I was invited to go to Norway with a SAS squadron in order to produce support for the northern flank of NATO. And I was taken to see Admiral Huitfeldt, who was Comnon at the time. And we got on extremely well. And as a result, we were able to deploy an SAS squadron, and I guess it's still there, supporting the northern flank of NATO. And we were very lucky to work with the Norwegian Patrol Company and Parachute Company at the time, who were, of course, taught us an enormous amount about living in cold weather conditions and snow, etc. And of course, that paid handsomely when we were in the Falkland Islands War, because by chance, the squadron that had been training in Norway for many years was the one that we used to deploy into the Falkland Islands, where the weather conditions were very similar. And the other great thing is, of course, we were able to add to the Norwegian patrol company's capability, and they were able to add enormously to ours. But so by collaboration together, and I hope it still exists, the close relationship we developed, we were able to develop and improve our capability, military capability. And I guess that's true of higher levels of command. And, you know, looking at what's happening in the world today, if NATO, Europe, Ukraine don't stand strong together against Putin's invasion of Ukraine, then of course the world would be a worse off place, and Putin will take courage from what he's done in Ukraine, and that simply cannot be allowed to happen. So starting at the small level, patrol company, SAS squadron working together, building those sort of levels of cooperation up, and of course it's happening in Estonia, Lithuania today, then we must keep that cohesion, and that is something that Putin won't be able to cope with in the future.
In Friends and Allies, we hear the stories of some of our closest supporters, reliving with them some of their most intense moments. Et øyeblikk, en evighet.